Steven Soderbergh is the talk of Tinseltown. His debut feature, Sex Lies and Videotape, won the Palme d'Or. It won Sundance before there even was a Sundance and was a massive box office hit. Surely, surely, he would stay the course and his follow-up would meet the lofty expectations surrounding him. Right, Keir? Okay. guess it's time to welcome you all to the Filmographers Podcast, the show where we study a director's entire career, one film at a time. I'm Michael Morisi.
And I'm Keir Graf. We're interested in the big picture. This season, we're turning the spotlight on Steven Soderbergh. We'll be discussing why each of his films succeeded or failed, looking at them in the context of the Hollywood landscape at the time it was released. Above all, we want to know how working artists make a life in the arts.
This is really a no-nonsense podcast. You know, we don't give plot summaries, and especially we don't futz around talking about how our day was or waste time trying to prove like how witty we can be. We're pretty witty, but we are here primarily and first and foremost for the movies.
This has been opened.
Oh. Shall I reseal it?
I understand you fancy yourself as a writer. You should find a more athletic hobby.
Academy Award winner Jeremy Irons is Kafka. To solve a mystery, he will enter a nightmare. Kafka, directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Keir, Kafka. Soderbergh's follow-up to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, released in 1991. Now, we've all heard of sophomore slumps, but this is really something. Now, before we dig in, Keir, describe the plot to me in just one sentence.
A naive insurance clerk in 1919 Prague investigates the mysterious disappearance of a colleague and finds himself ensnared in a web of sinister bureaucrats, bomb-throwing anarchists, and brain-bending mad scientists, and writes two letters to his father.
You know, up until that last bit, that sounds like an awesome movie.
It's the final letter that kills me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, get ready. We're going to talk a lot about that letter. But, okay, so Soderbergh's coming off of Sex Lies, okay? And from what we were able to glean, he had three different scripts that he could have made. One was The Last Ship, which he said, I don't know the exact particulars, but it was basically a Cold War movie, and the Cold War ended. So he was like, it wasn't really relevant anymore, and it seems like he just kind of lost a little bit of interest.
I mean, in his diaries for Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he talks about seeing the paperback on a airport or on a paperback spinner or something, grabbing a couple of copies, and kind of it reinvigorates his attention. And for a while, even though he's being offered a lot of things post Sundance, he was pushing pretty hard to make The Last Ship. And I believe he had Sidney Pollack involved as a potential producer.
I think so, yeah.
And so it seems it's like a weird choice. For a while, he was pushing really hard, but he was also being offered these other projects.
Yes, one of which was King of the Hill, another novel, which he actually ends up making after this one. And we'll have an episode to that. And the third is Kafka, which he thought was unfilmable. And I don't think the movie's unfilmable. I just don't think it's very good.
Right. So he read the script for Kafka by Lem Dobbs when he was before he made Sex, Lies, and Videotape, right? He was,
he was
kicking around Hollywood and he was doing various things and he'd read it and he thought it was a brilliant screenplay. But yeah, as you said, he thought it was unfilmable. So naturally he became fixated on making it.
Right. Right. He makes Kafka. And at this point, and we'll talk about this, it's kind of, we're wondering what movies and what filmmaker he's going to be, right? I mean, typical thing for a nascent filmmaker, but we're kind of looking at that, right? Who is Steven Soderbergh, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think based on the, I mean, now we have a very different opinion of Steven Soderbergh as this, somebody who's flexible, who can apply his talents to many different things. But at that time, and we're going to be talking about this definitely over the first half dozen episodes, a lot of people, critics, film fans, were just asking themselves, you know, who the hell is Steven Soderbergh? What kind of films does he want to make?
Yes. So, but right now, the film that he made, number two, was Kafka.
It was a real number two. Oh, sorry.
It's not that bad. We actually both kind of like it, so we don't want to set the expectations that this is going to be our diss track. But like, I mean, what did you think of it just overall? Because you've watched a few, we both have watched it a few times now.
Yes, absolutely. Like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, it's a film that I saw at the time. Didn't connect to it a lot at the time. I've rewatched it multiple times in preparation for the podcast, of course. And there are some really great things about it. I think that the soundtrack is excellent. I think that it has a remarkably engaging title sequence. I was excited sitting down to watch the film. I was excited for what would follow. I love the black and white. I think he does an amazing job of capturing a period feel. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Guy Madden. I love the films of Guy Madden how it almost sometimes feels like you're watching something that's made, you know, shot on a camera that's appropriate to the time. I don't know enough about the technical aspects of filmmaking to say, you know, what Soderbergh did or didn't do to make this look appropriate, but it just looked like a film of its era. And so I was all primed to like it. I think one of my big issues with it is that I feel Jeremy Irons is really miscast.
Yeah.
I did like him more on the second viewing, but Franz Kafka, a Jew from Eastern Europe who is you know, I think that the part of the idea, this is part biopic, it's part of mystery thriller. And the idea is, to portray Kafka himself as one of his characters, like this cog in this faceless, impersonal bureaucracy. Irons is somebody I love, and I think he does his best. But who do we think of? What do we think of when we think of Irons? We think of this guy, this is kind of like aristocratic guy, but often kind of slimy at the same time. Like he's great at the, what's the word, louche,
Right.
But his impeccable diction and his kind of classic English aristocratic bearing or something just didn't seem right. I kept thinking, like, why didn't they get John Turturro for this role?
Oh my God, that would have been amazing.
Wouldn't that have been great?
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially, I don't know if like Barton Fink was before or after this. I mean, it's pretty close.
I think it's, we should look that up.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like it's almost like a similar existence, Barton Fink and Kafka, like both in hell to some degree.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And interestingly, side note, Soderbergh talks about Barton Fink a little bit in relation to his next movie that we'll be talking about in our next episode. So
really?
Yeah, because they both prominently feature hotels.
Okay. So that's the connection. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But so, yeah, I think ultimately, I mean, I had some issues with some of the casting. Again, like I think Alec Guinness was a nice cameo, but it's kind of the same problem with Jeremy Irons. Armin Mueller-Stahl was probably more appropriate casting to the film. But it's a great looking movie that doesn't really know what it wants to be. I thought that the aspects that were more successful were the kind of mystery and the absurdity and the Kafka trying to navigate this bizarre bureaucracy. Every time, however, it touched on Kafka's actual biography, it started to fall flat for mm-hmm. me. Sometimes it felt very obvious, as when the Yaron Krabbe character is talking to him about the stuff he's written, Kafka asks that character to, you know, if I should not come back from the castle, please burn my papers. And that felt so heavy-handed, because anybody who knows anything about Kafka knows that was it's a reference to a real life request. Yeah. That stuff just didn't feel relevant. It felt to me like an uneasy balance, and all the actual biographical stuff I didn't care about.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think we had a similar reaction. I feel like there's two movies wrestling to get out of Kafka. One I found really interesting, one I did not. And the one that I did like was the mystery. Like, there is this Fritz Langian, German expressionistic, like, he's definitely going for that Lang Metropolis, you know, that kind of shadow and darkness, an Eastern European movie that, like, is definitely in the DNA of this movie. And it's like this weird mystery of what's going on. And that's one part of it. And the second part of it is, like you said, is this meta Kafka biopic that he's like a character in his own movie, in his own story, but he's not quite like Kay, and he's not quite Kafka. And I just don't know what is supposed to be going on there. And so you have these two sides, and neither side is Soderbergh finds a way to elevate either side. You know, like, we're probably going to talk about this a lot. Like, there's a sense that the movie doesn't know what it wants to be.
Agreed.
And there's, because of that, like, nothing is elevated. Nothing feels special. Like, it just feels like if you were watching the movie and someone described it, you're like, and you watch it and you're like, oh yeah, this is what it should be. You know, I'm reminded of, you know, the E.M. Forster quote, where he talks about flat characters versus round characters. And what makes a character round is the ability to surprise you. A flat character is, you know, one-dimensional and will always do what's expected, anticipated. And a round character will surprise you and do interesting new things, but are still true to the character. This movie feels very flat. Yep. Like, there's really nothing surprising. By the time you get to the third act, it's kind of surprising, because you're like, wow, this got really weird and has this sci-fi element going on. And it was interesting, but I don't know that he had, he being Soderbergh, a very specific goal or passion about what was going on in this. And the end result is just kind of an okay movie. And it's kind of has shown, you know, like, it's kind of lost. You know, you really can't get it on DVD. You really can't find it on streaming. It's just kind of gone now, which is unfortunate, but I think there's a reason for that. It's just because a movie that, like, Soderbergh didn't know what to do with it, I don't think.
Well, initially I was going to do a film called The Last Ship, which was about a naval destroyer that survives World War III.
This was Sidney Pollack,
right? Yes, yeah. Right. And fortunately, for a lot of reasons, I couldn't crack it, and I set it aside. And now, as it turns out, it's probably an irrelevant film to make, whether that's right or not, that we aren't thinking about nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
I immediately turned to Kafka, which is something I'd wanted to do since I first read it in 1985.
What was it about it that made you want to do it?
Well, I'd been interested in the ideas that Kafka wrote about, but the great thing about the script was that it wasn't an exam, you know what I mean? It wasn't highfalutin in any way. It was a mystery thriller that happened to have a protagonist named Kafka, and it was exciting. It was accessible. It was something anybody could enjoy.
It feels like a very classic sophomore effort in that, you know, people talk about this in the world of music a lot. I mean, I know albums are less of a thing than they used to be, but you know, the classic thing is that a band recording an album, and this is true often of novelists and screenwriters as well, but somebody who's trying to break in has all this time to put their whole being into the first offering, right? The first album, the first film, the first novel. And they've had years to do it. And then if they have a big success with that, suddenly there's this compressed window in which they're being asked to repeat that. And they're at the same time that their head is sort of spinning from success, which is certainly true of Soderbergh. I mean, he talks about having conversations with Robert Redford about the pitfalls of success and, you know, how to like navigate things in Hollywood. But he clearly, to me, Soderbergh seems like a very level-headed person, but it just clearly seems to me like his head is spinning because he's considering three projects that are so different from each other. They're all so very, very different. And it feels like he kind of rushed into this without knowing what he wanted to do, as you say. And it's just, if he would have pared away all the biographical stuff, I think it could have been more successful. I still don't think it would have been a great movie.
Well, that movie's called Dark City, which we'll talk about in a bit.
Yeah, we definitely need to talk about that.
But like, yeah, the moments, as we alluded to, like the biographical stuff, they write in his real life kind of, fiance. She makes a couple of appearances and then just never comes back. It doesn't matter. They should have just cut her out of the movie entirely. There are these letters to the father. The first one is sort of successful in that it has a little bit of a meta thing where he's kind of composing different endings to the letter in his voiceover track, which is a nice little moment, but ultimately doesn't help the film that much. And then at the end, as we discussed before we started recording, the movie is over. It actually lands on a really nice ending. And then he continues it on for 3 or 4 minutes and it ends with him composing yet another letter, which is the worst way I can think of to end a movie.
I mean, and he gets sick and we're like, oh, I didn't realize he was ill and, you know, fatally.
Oh, and by the way, he's sick and he'll die.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happens to Kafka. But it's again, it's like, if you don't really know that, you're like, oh, I guess he just, the experience killed him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to throw in something that is a little hot of a take.
Okay.
I want to get into the craft, but like, part of it is, I think you're right, like this knee-jerk reaction that Soderbergh has. Because I think when he came out with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he was labeled, and we spoke about this, he's like the indie darling winning, you know, the Sundance or American Film Festival, you know what it was called, the indie success that became big. And he went hard into the art house lane because he was like kind of labeled as an art house director.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is part of the process. And we'll talk about the necessity that he talks about, the necessity of failure and trial and error and this stuff. But like he went really into, and it's not total art house, but it's black and white. It's expressionistic. You know, it's all these things that are very kind of unique and it's whittling down the audience. And he's really trying to make something of craft and it's artful. I don't think I think I can confidently say that is not the director that Steven Soderbergh is. He's not quite a studio director. He's somewhere in between, and that's something we'll explore. But I think the impetus for it, like, oh, I'm an art house indie darling, so I got to make this next art house movie, wasn't true to him necessarily.
And talk about an art house move. Not only does he make it in black and white, he then cuts to color for a long passage in the middle of the film and then back to black and white. Talk about something that many audiences are going to find alienating. What's your take on the color segment in the middle of the film?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. On one hand, I don't get it, but I know. So that era of film, like 30s and 40s, which where Fritz Lang is coming from, which, by the way, a quick Easter egg that I think you know, the Murnau, Dr. Murnau,
yes,
is the director of, you know, Nosferatu.
Yes. So
there's a clear, you know, connection to this, like, German film history. Or it could also be Dr. Murnau, you know, it was the island Dr. Murnau. You can kind of play with either. But, like, the film looks like it's like, when it gets to color, it looks like he's doing, and I'm not sure, but it looks like he's at least attempting to do like a three-strip Technicolor, which is like a technique that they used before we had, you know, real true color, like Robin Hood. The Errol Flynn Robin Hood is three-strip Technicolor. But also the Michael Curtiz movie, Dr. X, which is a movie that I love, is like this really weird and just gnarly pre-code horror movie, is a three-strip Technicolor movie.
Oh.
And it looks like this, and it looks like Kafka, and it's actually, there's some overlap between those movies. So again, if you know the Kafka biography, if you know the Fritz Lang movies that he's referencing, and if you know Dr. X, you're like, oh, I get what he's doing here. But like, even knowing that, it doesn't do a whole lot for the enjoyment of Kafka in general. It kind of enhances it, and you're like, oh, I get the game that's afoot, you know? Yeah. But like, otherwise, I don't think it even that does a whole lot. I mean, look, he directs the hell out of it. It looks great. I mean, it looks great. Like the third man,
The camera framing is just amazing. The shot framing. Yeah. It's dead on. And some of the composition of some of the cabaret scenes of the faces of the people at the little bar or whatever are just terrific. I loved the way so much of this movie looked.
Yeah. Yeah. It goes to show, like, you know, there are some filmmakers, and I won't name names, but I can think of them in my head, that like they make their second movie and you're like, does this person know how the camera works? And it gets that bad, you know, and that's certainly not the case here with Soderbergh. It's still a very competent, well-made, despite what I just said, it's still an artful movie. But it's just not a very particularly interesting one.
Yeah, he has said that he is somebody who's really motivated by story and acting and performance, but is also very technically adept. And I think that's very true. I mean, he really seems to understand. I mean, in his diaries, he talks about, you know, going up to the projection booth and chewing out projectionists, you know, because they haven't, you know, had the, I don't remember the technical term, but they haven't, you know, taken care of the lenses of the projectors and stuff. So he clearly is somebody who knows all that, but it's kind of ironic because the problem with this film is it's the performances and it's the story. It's the thing that he's supposed to be good at.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the ingredient that's really missing. So we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the success or lack thereof that Kafka got upon its release.
My superiors have no obligation to explain their directives to me, and certainly not to you.
I just thought today might be different.
Why should today be different?
So, as you might imagine, Kafka was not a box office success. It was made for a reported $11 million and only pulled in a little over a million. I think it was like 1.5, if we're being generous. And it's not like since then, unfortunately, like I said, it hasn't been rediscovered since and recouped some of the shortfall. There's no Criterion version of it. There's really nothing that exists. I mean, the only DVD I was able to find is like I believe a Korean version or Japanese version or something like that. I didn't buy it, but I did see it on eBay, and it was an all region disc, so you can get it, but it's all but gone. Kind of, I mean, you get on streaming. I think it's big in Japan. I think that's where it made the 0.5 million.
You can stream it on Amazon Prime, which is not true of the next movie we'll be discussing in our next episode. But yes, so it is. It's available, but as you say, people don't really talk about it. I mean, I think some fans remember it, but it's not like a beloved cult classic or anything. It's just sort of almost forgotten.
And it's also like not like Soderbergh. You know, there's always those annoying directors who are like, oh, well, my favorite movie is the one no one ever saw. It's like, you know, your eyes are not meant to roll that hard. You know, Soderbergh doesn't talk about this movie. You know, you don't see him being like, you know, you guys really should go rediscover Kafka.
One of the things I love about him in interviews is he often is talking about these early films, and he's as hard on them as we are. And I think that is one of the things I admire about him so much is that, yeah, he doesn't fall into a defensive stance when he's talking about his films that came up short. In fact, he looks at them and in a way that is sort of like, well, you know, what could I have done better? He takes the lessons and applies them. However, in some cases, he has actually recut these early films and then screened them sometimes just once, just to kind of probably just to satisfy himself because he's so frustrated that it didn't go better in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing is that there is a cut of this movie called Mr. Neff that he recut the whole thing. And also for people who don't know, he also recuts other movies, like, which is the gift that keeps on giving. He recut, or he didn't recut Raiders of the Lost Ark. He just put it in black and white and took out the sound. And you can watch on his website. It's amazing. It's amazing. It just shows how great, you know, yeah, Spielberg's craft is. He recut Heaven's Gate and just was like in his spare time because he's so compulsive about that stuff. But anyway, so but Mr. Neff was his recut of Kafka, which it added some scenes that weren't in originally. And I think they even reshot a little, and he released it. It is screened, as far as I was able to tell, like twice, maybe once. And he was going to release it, allegedly, part of his, newsletters, if you're also on his website, as a 7-disc DVD set, include with other movies he had gotten the rights back to. But it hasn't happened. That release hasn't happened. I'm dying for it because I really want to see this new cut. And he never posted this either. So unless you saw it screened, Mr. Neff,
I think he screened at the Toronto Film Festival or something. Yeah. I mean, what an amazing, I mean, that is just mind blowing to me, that kind of level. I mean, I've written things, and I won't tell you what, but I have written things that maybe I thought were a little less successful. I don't go back and rewrite them and republish them. I just move on. The fact that he has done so many movies and he still finds the time, and this is a time consuming effort to recut a film.
Yeah. And it's so funny because, like, it's almost like, you see that more and more. It's funny because, like, when you're talking about how, like, Steven Soderbergh's able to roll the punches, you know, critically and, you know, with success or lack thereof, you know, you have the opposite, which is Ridley Scott, who will lash out to anybody, you know, and anyone. But he's also somebody who recut his movies, you know, who released multiple cuts.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes, like, you know, it's a tangent. In the case of Kingdom of Heaven, it's a completely different movie. Like, it's wild to me that you can pull, you know, this kind of content from just depending on how you cut it. It's fascinating. And Soderbergh's one of those guys, though.
So here's what I'll tell you. I made a movie 30 years ago that I felt had some issues. And everybody who saw it thought it had some issues. And so that happens sometimes, and you gotta move beyond that. But about 15 years later, the producer, financier of the film called me and he said, all the rights have reverted back to us. Do you wanna go back in and look at this? And I said, sure. So I kind of pushed it around for a long time. And then during lockdown, I thought, you know, I really need to take this seriously and look at it, but what it needs is an approach. There needs to be a persona that is going to attack this thing with very specific ideas in mind. So I created this persona in my mind of a kind of deranged critic slash fan who, and this deranged critic slash fan has access to all of the original elements of the film, including the B negative. This deranged person has access to a small insert stage and a leftover stock of black and white film. This person has access to all of my playlists. And this person has access to a garbage bag full of weed. And off we go.
Quick aside, Mike, what's your opinion on director's cuts?
You know, I think they're a necessity because it's unfortunate that they don't get the cut they want often that gets released, you know, like, the studio, you know, studio interference, time, you know, they just need to get it out. The movie gets taken away from them. So sometimes director's cuts to me, are usually in an ideal world, that's what will get released, but that's not always the case.
No.
So I like that they exist. I mean, sometimes I think it's a little too much. Like Kingdom of Heaven, I feel like Ridley didn't find the movie, you know, until like a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And they just released something, and that something was not very good, and the other version is superior. But in general, I do like them. How about you?
I feel like there should be a jury composed, you know, of Directors Guild of America bigwigs who would approve who gets to have a director's cut and who doesn't, because certainly there are some cases where it's essential. I mean, Blade Runner, you know, the right. first director's cut was a vast improvement and really necessary. However, I feel like it's become a little bit too reflexive, and just we live in a crowded pop culture landscape where everybody's releasing the definitive album with extra tracks, or, you know, on Spotify, it drives me crazy when I want to listen to like a classic album and suddenly they're 8 new tracks
right.
at the end. I don't care. Like, I just want the classic version that I remember. I don't want the studio outtakes that were not judged good enough to be on the first record. So I guess I'm, you know, obviously it would be weird to say directors shouldn't, you know, get a director's cut. I just feel like it's a little overused sometimes because people just didn't put enough into it in the first place, or it's just kind of like we get another swing, we can market something else. And I certainly think that people should be limited to one director's cut, because there are offenders yeah. who come back again and
Ridley
again.
Scott.
Yeah, Ridley Scott. And
we're for real this time cut.
Yeah.
This is it.
I'm sorry. One director's cut, because it's a world full of movies, and we can't watch them all.
No. And part of, you know, part of making art and writing and directing is one of the biggest parts of it is decision making, you know, and you have to make these decisions of like every step of the way. And a director's cut kind of like allows you to circumvent that. Like, I don't have to make any decisions. I'm just going to put it all in, you know, like, and you're like, well, but you, some of that needed to go.
That's a good point. Yeah. And part of art is making decisions and then living with regret at times.
A lot of regret.
Yeah. and these new media allow us to kind of maybe be a little less decisive, you know, thinking like we can fix it later. I mean, certainly, you know, just, I'm getting way off track here, but, you know, obviously with, you know, CGI and things, like, people now can just say, well, we'll fix it later. I think that directors who knew that they had to commit the shot on film on the day they were making it, those people were masters because they had to be decisive. They had to know what they were going to get. And then they knew they were going to have to live with the consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, you know, like, you see like some of like Spielberg, I just watched his, from Last Crusade, where there was the Nazi march, where the camera is like, it comes down a crane to the march to like following this action where they knock out a Nazi guard. Then he comes back and he joins his dad. And it's like, this all one continuous, very calculated take that you cannot, you don't get it in post.
Yeah.
Like, either
yeah.
you get it or you don't. But going back to our good friend, Steven Soderbergh, you know, what's interesting to me is that, like, he's a guy, and we'll talk about this a lot, who we now know with the, you know, value and the privilege of time, that he has really good instincts. He makes really good decisions. You know, even his movies that aren't successes now, I would say, and this is post like Ocean's 11-ish, you know, the movies that aren't successes, you can see like how they could have been a success. Like, The Informant wasn't a success. And even though it's a movie that I think is great, you're like, well, it had Matt Damon, you know, so that it had a shot, you know. The Girlfriend Experience was a little bit of a disappointment, but it's since gone on to launch its own TV series, which I think is successful. But you're like, oh, well, it has the novelty of Sacha Grey, and it's has some naughtiness to it. So like, whether he's making movies big or small, like, he's figuring out like how in the marketplace they're going to work and how he can make them a success. But the thing about Kafka is like we said, he had more choices, and that's only the choices that we yeah. knew of. So there, yeah. I find it hard to believe that coming out of Sex Lies and all the buzz out of Sundance and all the calls he was getting and everything that was the spotlight that is on him, he probably had more than three choices, more than at least three offers. Those are the three most that we mentioned were three most serious.
Yeah.
And I just can't wrap my head around why he picked Kafka.
there were definitely some other things kicking around. And he was also considering making one of his own scripts, you know, from that he had written before. I mean, an interesting thought experiment would be to think like, well, what if instead of making Kafka next, and we know he made one of the other ones for his third film, but what if The Last Ship had gotten made? What if he had made this big budget film on a, like a warship? Apparently some people were kind of trying to dissuade him from that, even though he was, for a while, it looked like that was the film he was pursuing the most. They were saying, it's just too big. Which it was probably good advice for somebody whose previous experience is directing, you know, four actors in houses in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to suddenly go to this big. It's not a war movie, but it's just a totally different scale of things, and the budget would have had to be even bigger.
Well, you said it best, and I'm going to steal this from you, but I'm crediting. Fail small. He is good at failing small. Like The Girlfriend Experience, I think that was like a budget of $1 million or $1.5 million, and I don't think he'd even recoup that. But like when he makes his failures, he does know how to fail small. There's a world of difference. Like, yeah, you know, Kafka was a pretty big swing and a miss. You know, $10 million, you know, in 1992 or three, whatever it was, is not a small amount of money. It's not a small amount of money now. But like, at least it wasn't $70 million.
Yes.
Because you're in director jail.
Yeah. Yeah. Had he made the last ship for a budget north of $50 million, I mean, that could have been a career ender.
Yeah.
He could have been, you know, directing Yes concert videos. What's another prog rock band from that era? He could have been, I don't know, a Journey concert documentary or something. Things could have turned out very differently for him. And he talks about this, I think I've got a quote I'm saving for the right moment, but he talks about how he was afforded the chance to make more mistakes than people would be today. And so for that, you know, the 90s were a more forgiving time, and we'll be exploring this as we go along this season, but it was a more forgiving time to be an independent filmmaker. And thank heavens for that, that he got to fail a few times. But I do think that had he made his first instinct, The Last Ship, things could have gone very differently for him.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, you bring up a good point about the 90s, because despite this movie not being a success, you know, in terms of, you know, financially or really even critically, you know, the critics were not warm on Kafka at all. Despite all that, it's a very 90s movie. Like, it's still like kind of like ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, you flash forward to all these other authoritarian sci-fi movies that, you know, we're dealing with the same stuff that Kafka is, with the individual versus the state. You know, you have The Matrix, you have Equilibrium, you have Gattaca, a little bit of Fight Club.
Sure.
And Dark City, which was written... Kafka was written by Lem Dobbs, who also wrote Dark City. So kudos, as writers, we can really appreciate he got paid twice for writing the same movie once.
Living the dream.
Yeah, like, I can't believe it. I can't believe, especially the last act, when it gets really even looks like it. Like, Alex Proyas directed Dark City. Like, it even looks like Dark City.
Yeah. Dark City is fascinating. I mean, that was kind of a film people were making for a while. It was like, you know, like The Matrix, The Truman Show, you know, like we're kind of trapped in this alternate reality kind of thing. Clearly, there's a lot of Brazil influence, I think, on Terry Gilliam's Brazil, for those who may not know. A lot of influence on Kafka and Dark City, I think. I kept thinking of that film over and over again while I was watching these movies. I liked Dark City pretty well. Like, it was pretty good. But yeah, the similarities to Kafka were fascinating. You know, people like literally, you know, opening people's heads up and tinkering with their brain chemistry. The big difference, of course, is in Kafka, they go through the top of the head, and Dark City, they go in through the front, you know, so that's totally very different. Right. Yeah. It's totally a different movie. Right.
I mean, that change had to, I mean, Lem Dobbs, it probably, that type took him 10 minutes at least to rub the, you know, serial numbers off of that thing.
Well, and apparently there was another Lem Dobbs screenplay that Soderbergh was so in love with, I can't recall the title,
Kafka City.
You gotta let me make Kafka City, Lem. But while he was working on pre-production for Kafka, he asked Lem, you gotta let me film this one too. And Lem said, no, I want to direct this one myself. I think it's probably for the best that Steve didn't do two Lem Dobbs scripts.
I agree. Even though I will fully admit, Dark City is probably my top 50 favorite movies of all time.
Oh, interesting.
I love it. I love it to death. And it's also one of my favorite film commentaries. Roger Ebert, he's only done, I believe, 3 commentary tracks. He did one from Dark City because he loves the movie so much. And it's a fascinating, amazing, for anybody who loves Ebert or loves that movie, the commentary is just terrific.
I'm going to have to check that out. Yeah. As I said, I enjoyed that movie. I liked it. I didn't maybe love it. I certainly didn't love it as much as you, but it was a hell of a lot more enjoyable than Kafka.
Agreed.
Sorry, Steve.
Sorry. I think he's probably nodding along right now as he's listening. So yeah, I think we should take another break. And when we get back, I have an interesting quote from Soderbergh himself that I think will spark some interesting conversation about what it's like to make art and what it's like to make choices. So we're back, and I'm going to read this quote from Soderbergh himself. This is taken from a Believer interview from quite a while ago, where as always, Soderbergh's very candid, and the Believer interviewer is asking which of his movies he would take back, and if there are any that he would take back. And Soderbergh says, no, just ones I do differently. They were sincere attempts. I think Kafka was a failure. King of the Hill, The Underneath, is a failure. I should have done that differently. I've made movies since that don't work for people. There are a lot of people that don't like Full Frontal and don't like Bubble. But I feel like I got what I was after with those films. I understood what I was trying to do. They succeeded on their own terms. But the earlier films, I just hadn't hit the next level yet. You know, I love that quote because also, like we said, he's a very candid guy. And he's very honest about his success. And he's very honest about his failure. But what I love most, what's most salient to what we're talking about, is his line, I understood what I was trying to do. The earlier films, I hadn't hit the next level yet.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about, as writers, you know, finding the story. And to me, and I think you'd agree, I would say it's everything, but at least it's very close. So tell me a little bit from your perspective, you know, like what that means, finding the story, like when he says, like, I didn't get what I was after.
Yeah. I mean, for me, finding the story is just, it's being able to articulate your story, you know, what you're trying to convey to audiences. Honestly, in a sentence, in my former life, I was an editor at a book review journal. I was the executive editor of Booklist Publications, and Booklist is a review journal published by the American Library Association. And I learned so much about story from working there for just shy of 18 years, during which time I did a lot of things, but I also reviewed a lot of books while I was there. And there's no better school for learning storytelling than to consume other people's stories voraciously on deadline and then summarize them very briefly. At Booklist, our reviews were written for the library market. They were written for busy librarians who didn't have the time to read all the books they were going to buy for their libraries. And so we wrote very short reviews. The average length was about 170 words. And that was not all plot summary, because a bad book review is all plot summary. We would summarize the plot to these books in a sentence or two. And what that taught me about my work was that if you cannot summarize what you're trying to achieve in a sentence or two, you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah.
I meet so many aspiring authors and they're working on a book and they're passionate about it, and I ask them what it's about and they hem and haw and talk about it for 10 or 15 minutes and I don't know. I've read a lot of commercially successful literary novels that I'm not convinced that the author knew what they were trying to convey. They really got lost in scene, and that can happen anyway. Sometimes I get a little lost at scene level because you're just so excited to have your characters interacting and firing off great dialogue or in some cool action sequence. But one of the reasons I like working with a co-author actually is I have an accountability buddy to remind me what this scene's role is in the entire story and to take us back to that little summary that we wrote at the very beginning, purely kind of storytelling plot level. But obviously there's also like a deeper level, like what's your story about? Like what's the deeper underlying meaning of your story? And if you can't articulate that in a sentence, you're also lost.
Yeah. I totally agree. And that's the way I think about it too. You know, it's like, I think about films that I love and I love them so much because I am big, and we'll talk about this, Soderbergh, I'm big on simplicity and clarity, which seems like, oh, it's so easy. It's actually harder. It's easier to be obtuse, I think. It's be like, well, what's the point? Whoa, you got to figure it out. It's like, no, you just don't have one. You know, like, and I think about a movie I just saw, The Boy and the Heron, which was brilliant and beautiful, and I loved it. And it's about dealing with an imperfect world. It's about the pain is worth the joy, you know, and that's it. That's what it's about. And not every single beat hits that, you know, of the movie, of the story, but you can distill it into this one thing. You know, I've been working on that script, you know, for a long time, came back on it. And I know it's about finding light and darkness. You know, maybe there's a little bit more that it's about. But if I don't have, as a writer or as somebody who's just viewing art, if I don't understand what it is, if I can't reach it, and especially if I'm a writer, if I can't, like you said, distill it into this one sentence, like this is what I'm trying to say. And the plot is something that that's the seed that the plot grows out of, you know? And if I don't have that, like then the whole thing is lost, you know, then I'm just kind of flailing around. And it's just so utterly vital. And you're right. I mean, I have those same conversations where it's like, you just need to pin it down. You know, I think one of my favorite filmmakers is Guillermo del Toro. You know, nobody does like, this is what it's about. You can watch his movies and like in an instant, like, you know what it is. And he dresses it up so beautifully. And that's the magic of it. But like in Kafka, for example, I don't know that he knew what it was about. Like, I don't know that he had that essential thing. He kind of wanted to be Metropolis, Fritz Lang. He kind of wanted to be a Kafka meta biopic. But I don't really know that he really had a idea or clarity. And I don't even know that he didn't seem too passionate about it. I mean, I don't want to put words or thoughts in his mind, but the fact that he doesn't talk about it, I think, says a lot.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about how he kind of ruined his own ending because he had the perfect ending. And I think that if he would have gone with where we both felt the movie should have ended, which is when Alec Guinness, as the chief clerk, as they call him, says to him, well, why should today be any different? After all this mayhem that has ensued, in the film, Kafka comes back to work and sort of thinks that the world has changed for him, and why isn't it changed outwardly? And I think if Soderbergh would have taken that moment and kind of like worked backwards, I think he could have found the film. He could have found the story.
I think so too.
And made it much more beautifully simple, and in a way that I think it could have been kind of like a minor film that people would, you know, still revere. It would have been kind of a nice footnote instead of this kind of like, you know, unsightly thing that we've swept under the rug. With Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I do feel that he knew what he wanted to do. And it is such a simple film. I mean, he said himself of it, when he was working on it, that he kind of felt like it was a short film that was just being stretched out to feature length. But I think that's one of the reasons it's fairly effective. It's just simple. And so it allows us to enjoy the performances and the interactions of the characters because we're not puzzled about what it is.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I think that if it would have taken that one line, you know, why should today be any different? And like you said, extended that out, like the hell. And we all understand that. It's such a relatable thing that I have changed, but everything else is the same.
Yeah.
That's a really beautiful point. That's a really, you know, he's going through, one would say, a metamorphosis. but the world is just as kind of grimy and seedy and mysterious and unknowable as it was, you know, the day before and the day before that, and we'll be like that tomorrow, no matter where I go. And that's a kind of very Kafka-esque thing. But he didn't really find that. You know, it's just this line and perfect line delivered by Alec Guinness. But he didn't really find that.
And I don't want to be the critic who, you know, says, oh, the artist should have done this. I mean, I guess we already have a little bit, but had that line been used in the same way you've just used these kind of other simple lines to describe the through line or the main story, the big idea of these other films, I think if he would have kind of like taped that to his computer or whatever while he was working on Kafka, he might have ended up in a much better place.
I agree. And you said it yourself. I think you gave us this quote last time where he talks about, like, you know, making movies like navigating a ship, you know, and if you go 1 degree off course every day or just a little bit, you find yourself somewhere totally different. But I think in this one, I don't even know that he had the destination. You know, I don't think he had the North Star that he was going toward. You know, I think he just put his ship out to sea. And
well, and one thing we hadn't mentioned yet is, I mean, we mentioned it, but we haven't like called it out, which is that, you know, the first script he wrote, this script is somebody else's script. And that's just a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talks about it a lot. You know, there's this interview book that I'd read where he talks about the fact that they did have to do a lot of rewriting. He did a lot of rewriting. He called in Lem Dobbs to do a lot of rewriting. They reshot some things that they weren't able to reshoot in the office, because the office that they built that in had, when they were done, the sets got torn down and that was gone. But they did reshoot quite a bit of things and rewrote either him or Dobbs. So I think that he was making those attempts. And I think you're right. I think there was a sense that, like, because it wasn't his, it was just such a different experience. And having read that, it's interesting because he was trying to, like, I don't want to say it was a lack of effort, but I think that that might have been part of it, is that it was somebody else's script and maybe he was precious about it and then discovered along the way, this isn't working. I need to get my hands in there. I need to call Dobbs back. And by that time, you know, once that, you know, it's like you're trying to fix a flat tire while the car's still moving, you know, it's just not going to happen.
And so for his first film, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he's written his own screenplay from his own original idea. Second screenplay, he's rewriting and working with somebody else's screenplay from their own original idea, but also kind of pulled from biographical sources and the fiction of Franz Kafka. His third film, as we'll be discussing in the next episode, yet again, a different approach. Mm-hmm. He's writing the screenplay from somebody else's memoir. So three movies, three different approaches to scripting. Maybe that has something to do with the fact that these films are pretty uneven.
Yeah, I think so. And I have some more ideas and thoughts about that as well, which we'll talk about next time. But Kier, before we wrap up, any last thoughts on Kafka?
I didn't say this earlier when I was talking about the casting and stuff. I thought the assistants to Kafka were delightful. It was like almost Marx Brothers or something. That was one of my favorite parts of the film, was the two assistants. What were the names? The assistant Oscar and assistant Ludwig. I found them just delightful every time they came on screen.
Yeah, so weird. This like vaudevillian, weird, you know, and some of it was just in the background.
Yeah.
Like it's just, they would, one, there's one scene where he pops out from under a desk and papers go flying and they're like, what? What is the tone here?
Yeah, again, partly a problem with the uneven tone, but boy, I just, those deserve to be called out, because what great little roles.
Yeah, I agree. I love them. I thought they were terrific. And I do like the exercise. It is cool to look at. I like, we didn't mention the film stock, you know, it's, I don't know what he used, but there's a lot of pops and cracks on the screen, you know, like, and you can't do that now. Like we talked about in post, like I just saw the Holdovers, which I was convinced was shot on film. And it's not. They're shot digitally. It's all these filters and all this stuff they did, filters during and then stuff in post. But you can't do what he, you can't achieve what he achieved. I mean, somewhat you can. I'm sure that like the Technicolor stuff maybe, but like the way that it looks, you know, it's all his filming. That's all his, you know, planning and preparation, which he's very good at. And the movie looks great. And as somebody who loves Fritz Lang and that type of movie, like I love it as an exercise.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it exists. But it's also not a movie that I would probably want to revisit. If I'm going to rewatch anything, I'll probably watch Dark City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and take a moment to give us a good rating or review on your platform of choice. Even better, tell a film-loving friend to join us on our journey to watch all the films of Steven Soderbergh. You can also follow us on Instagram @thefilmographers or on X at FilmographerPod or on Letterboxd.
Yeah, and special thanks to our producer, Kevin Lau, and our logo designer, Cosmo Graff.
And Gompson, who composed and played our theme music. If you have suggestions, feedback, or just want to share a fun Soderbergh fact with us, email us at thefilmographerspodcast@gmail.com.
And like we've teased already, next week on the Filmographers Podcast, we'll be looking at Soderbergh's third film, which ended up being the inspiration for a Mike Judge animated series, right?
I was trying to think of something Hank Hill would say.
I've actually never watched that show. So.
Bobby, I think you'll enjoy it.